Well, it must be really spring. It's the last day of the Masters, so I wore my golf bow tie. We've had so many ups and downs with our daily roller coaster temperature changes, we can't trust the calendar sometimes, even down here south of the Mason-Dixon line. We lived in Augusta, Georgia, where the Masters golf tournament is held every year, the first week of April. And we were there my first year as the minister to that church, that Unitarian Universalist congregation in Augusta, the first year that Tiger Woods won the championship in 1997. And I got to actually walk on the green grass of the Augusta National Golf Course and look out there and see all those incredible azaleas all around on both edges of every fairway, every green. It was incredible. But of course, we got to be there for 9 years, and some years the azaleas bloomed in March, way too early. And the story is told how the greenskeepers have to pack ice around the azaleas to try to hold back when it's warm too soon in March and try to hold back the blooming azaleas, which are so important when you're watching on television. And those of us who are really hooked on golf, which I've watched less golf since I became 17 than I did in all the years before I was 17. I probably have watched 20 or 30 minutes a year of golf, usually the Masters, just because it was such a spectacle to watch what was going on with Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and those classic accomplished golfers of 50 years ago. But when you're on the course, walking through on the par three pro-am days before the actual tournament, they will sell you pimento cheese sandwiches, but they have to be wrapped in green paper so that if some of them get away from the groundskeepers, they don't mess up the television photography, so that whatever you see on television looks really green all the time because they are so fastidious about keeping up the appearances of what's going on at the Masters. And, of course, they have those actually what I think of as ugly green jackets. They're not my kind of jackets at all. I've never owned a green jacket in my life, and probably – If I tried to put one on, my wife would tell me my fashion taste was inappropriate. But our combined solar and lunar calendar of Christianity, which, of course, everything is built around Christianity in our Western society, it tells us that today is Palm Springs, the week before Easter. But the Jewish lunar calendar tells us that tomorrow evening begins the traditional observance of Passover, celebrating the deliverance of the Hebrews from generations of enslavement in Egypt over 3,000 years ago. As the story has come down through the millennia in the book of Exodus of the Torah, Moses, who is raised in the household of Pharaoh, but has to reclaim his birthright Jewish heritage when the burning bush manifests the presence of Yahweh, the Jewish God, to him, charging Moses with the duty to lead his people out of bondage. But Moses cannot convince Pharaoh to free the Jews voluntarily. But a series of plagues affect all the Egyptians, but not the Jews. They're called down by Moses at the direction of Yahweh. In the final plague, only those households which show on the doors the blood of a proper Jewish sacrifice are able to avoid the visitation of the angel of death upon their children, their most important part of their lives, bringing forth children to regenerate the earth, to regenerate their Jewish identity. And so, the Jewish identity, which had had negative secular value in their time of enslavement under Pharaoh, became a priceless asset when their God Yahweh spared them as the plagues were visited upon their oppressors. And even after Moses, we know from history as well as the Bible that the Jewish tribal identity has always continued to go through alternating cycles of great prosperity and terrible persecution as the chosen people settled throughout the world where they were seen as other, marginalized, and repressed. The Christian variant of what we now know is a Christian variant of Judaism was informed by the life of Jesus and interpreted by the Roman Paul, was likewise brutally repressed by secular rulers for hundreds of years. But Christianity over time has become elevated, and first by becoming the state religion of the entire Roman Empire through the adoption of the cross as a symbol of power in war by Constantine in the 4th century. And of course, the Christian identity has now become the standard of value in modern America at the expense of discrimination against minority faiths. But what about the value of Unitarian Universalist identity, our own late-blooming revision of Judeo-Christian theology? Clearly, even as late as the early 19th century, both Unitarians and Universalists, like their Jewish ancestors, were outlawed and persecuted by law and by custom in Britain and wherever there were established churches. Our liberal religious ancestors in Britain and Europe paid a high price, over and over again, for their insistent resistance to much of the dominant dogma of the established churches. They were deprived of civil rights and property merely because they refused to conform, the same reason that the Inquisition took out so many who were Protestant or Jewish, made them conform or move away or sublimate their true identities. But as tolerance of our faith developed, the primary focus in this country also increasingly moved away from shaping inclusive creeds toward forming covenants of community, covenants which were about conscience and covenants which were about consciousness. At the time of the American Revolution, the idealistic assertions of religious liberalism were at the core of the deliberations and writings of our founding fathers, as well as the precursors to the development of explicitly Unitarian and Universalist theology as it developed over the past 200 years. But over time, the Industrial Revolution, which accompanied the rise of mercantilist capitalism, seems to have overwhelmed those collectivist ideals in society, even as Unitarian and Universalist churches and our association have become even more egalitarian in theory and practice. You might ask, how is this manifest in American society? 5 years ago, my colleague Jay Leach, the minister of a large UU church in Charlotte, put together an award-winning sermon, which I found on the worship web of our association. And I think I would like to adapt some of his core message because it's especially timely for us again in these days. I will paraphrase much of his words. In recent political debates, we don't hear much honest discussion about the idea of commonwealth, although it was the original concept on which the colonies of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts were actually founded. Perhaps the idea of commonwealth seems to be an anachronism now at odds, with what seems to be the continual question, what's in it for me? Jay Leach quoted Professor Frank Kirkpatrick, a religious ethicist, who wrote about his own search for a common good in political discourse by making observations about the politicians who avoid the concept of commonwealth. He said, for many politicians, the notion of the common good seems somewhat embarrassing. Why should that be so? And 5 years ago, he answered in these words, the common good is a notion that should trump rhetoric of radical individualism and minimal government. It is an uncomfortable notion that does not sit easily with the call to free everyone from the burdens of having to care for others, especially when such care may require a tax on one's own resources. In other words, we can't afford to care for other people because we'll have to give up some of what we have. We can't afford to make allowances for people who are impoverished because the billionaires may have to give up a higher percentage of their income. We can't afford to care about the minorities or the immigrants or the refugees because they may threaten our comfortable standard of living in some ways. But over the past several years, this can particularly be seen in the increasing unpopularity of Obamacare provisions, which mandate health insurance coverage for essentially everyone, and the special taxes on higher earners, which actually are needed to subsidize premiums for lower earners. Jay Leach, in his presentation, went on to assert that perhaps the most radical, controversial, countercultural message that Unitarians of this day and age can offer may not be about marriage equality or economic justice or environmental activism or any of the other social stances which we find so important, even though those are all important. But our most radical, controversial, countercultural message just may be our affirmation that each of us, every single individual human being, is part of this interdependent web of all existence, which is a part of our principles as Unitarian Universalists. To make such an affirmation with full integrity suggests that the question, what's in it for me, is directly and completely subsumed by the question of what's in it for all of us on Earth. If the web of existence of which we are a part truly is interdependent, really interdependent, then there can be really only the common good. Jay Leach reminds me that this radical notion is not new. He notes how our 19th century religious icon, Ralph Waldo Emerson, is mischaracterized as a hardcore individualist, like the more well-earned reputation of his protege, Thoreau. In Emerson's essay, The Oversoul, he presented the concept of a unity of thought in which every heart beats to a larger imbibing of the common heart. He dares assert that the heart in you is the heart of all. He actually believed in the infinite enlargement of the human heart. This would suggest that health itself must always be concerned with public health. Well-being can never be private, can never be isolated or individual. Isn't this even more true today? We know, for example, that viruses like Zika and Ebola and polio and measles can now manifest around the globe in a manner of days, much as influenza arising in Europe during World War I killed many more American soldiers than the bullets fired at them by the Germans and their allies. We also know that coastal cities are being routinely inundated by higher tides and encroaching storms of greater and greater intensity, while thermometers around the world are notching historic record highs year after year. These are facts, not alternative facts, facts. So our collective sense of responsibility and accountability for all life on Earth is not an exclusively Unitarian franchise, but it is a hallmark of our particular faith that we know and we accept that we must do all we can to ensure that the precious life we share today is not lived at the expense of others, and especially not at the expense of our descendants. And that is why on this day of our dedication to these beautiful children, who exemplify all the children of not only of our community, but the world, on this Christian Palm Sunday of hope, we must call ourselves to conscientious awareness of our collective charge to act on behalf of the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, to make sure that we leave a legacy of life in abundance. Isn't it up to us to widen our focus from the details of our individual lives, to reach out and connect with others who share our worldview? Isn't it our charge, as we see the truth, to share that vision with others who are just beginning to perceive that the dominant paradigms can be destructive of the common good? We may not be able to see a literal burning bush on our path like the one which called out to Moses. But isn't it true that there are already some metaphorical wisps of smoke which we can see, which should alert us that a fire is in the making? It is no longer possible, if indeed it ever was, for any of us to benefit from a figurative Passover, however virtuous we might try to be. Despite our religious identity, we cannot be insulated or spared from the tragic consequences of the greatest literal or metaphorical plagues which we can see coming. Whether directly or indirectly, we will be affected because we are irrevocably interconnected. But there can be no question that the value of this community to us and to the world is priceless. Our Unitarian Universalist heritage and our present identity call upon us to value what we have. And so it is our privilege and our burden to challenge each other and ourselves to do all we can to ensure that this little community and its sister congregations are as healthy as possible. It is in this community that we can be sustained and refueled for the struggles ahead. And it is in our interconnected liberal religious identity, in partnership with others who find themselves on the same path, that we can leverage our small efforts to make a difference in the world. Your time, your energy, your talents, your resources, but most of all, your passion are needed now and in the dark days ahead. For the darkest days are just before the dawn of a new day. Returning again to the roots of Judeo-Christian theology, Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is at the forefront of the progressive network of spiritual progressives, an editor of Tikkun magazine, promoting the health and reclaiming of the unity of life, inspires me with a Passover article this week. I read his articles pretty much every week, and I get his magazine. I'm a member of his organization, and I find him inspirational. He's on the cutting edge of what we might call radical Judaism today. He writes, "We know the world can be healed and transformed. This is the whole point of the telling the Passover story. Our task is to find the ways to continue the struggle for liberation in our own times and in our own circumstances. Some of those ways suggested by Michael Lerner include recognizing each other as allies in that struggle, supporting each other even though we can clearly see each other's flaws and inadequacies. I don't know about you, but I'm not perfect. Can you say that? I don't know about you, but I'm not perfect. Can you say that? Say it! Great! We're in the same ballpark. Pouring out love into the world, even when we don't have a good excuse for giving that love to others, even when it seems corny or risky to do so, thus breaking down our own inner barriers to loving others and to loving ourselves. Rejecting the cynical view that everyone is always out for themselves, that there is nothing but selfishness, and instead allowing ourselves to see that we are actually surrounded by people who would love to live in a world based on love, justice, and peace if they thought that others would join them in building such a world. In other words, giving up that negative expectation and hoping and working to find that we are on a common enterprise. The next thing, taking the risk of articulating our own agenda of social change based on love, even though it may mean risking some of our economic security, some of our physical security, and perhaps even risking the alienation of some of our friends and families. Tough job, tough risk, but might be necessary. The next thing, allowing ourselves to envision the world the way we really would like it to be, not getting stuck in spiritually crippling talk about what is concrete or realistic. The stories of Passover and Palm Sunday are stories about hope, how hope can inspire us to make transformation happen, overcoming obstacles. On this particular day, we have the opportunity to begin to affirm our connection with a different truth, that the world can be governed by a force of transformation and healing, the Tikkun Olam, the healing of the world, that we are literal embodiments of a universal spirit of life and love, and therefore we must assert the capacity to join with each other to transform the world we live in. We know, historically, the oppressive ancient Egyptian regime in which Jews lived as slaves was eventually overthrown, mostly despite the efforts of many to hold it up. The Passover story, which I've shared with you today in its elements, reminds us that in every age, we must continue our own struggles for liberation, for greater justice, which Jews experienced as a result of the first Passover over 3,000 years ago. Let us go forth with that inspiration in mind in a day like today. Nina found a specific poem that I'd like to share with you. It has relevance about our political system, but it also has relevance about our Unitarian Universalist Association, which for those of us who were involved with it know is in turmoil right now over some failures of leadership, some failures of human beings. It was shared by our friend who is a Black Unitarian Universalist minister, Janice Marie Johnson. She says, "Together we will create brave space because there is no such thing as a safe space. We exist in the real world. We all carry scars and we have all caused wounds. In this space, we seek to turn down the volume of the outside world. We want to amplify voices that fight to be heard elsewhere. We call each other to more truth and love. But we have the right to start somewhere and to continue to grow. We have the responsibility to examine what we think we know. We will not be perfect. The space that we choose will not be perfect. It will not always be what we wish it to be, but it will be our brave space together, and we will work in it side by side. That is our opportunity, our responsibility, our chance to make this world better." Thank you for your attention this morning.